I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. I'm Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. And today we're going to talk about the beginning of a new era, political era, in the United States. And it started on January 20th. And that's when newly elected and sworn in President Joe Biden took office. And there's a couple of things I wanted to talk about, Amy. And
yeah.
The first thing I'm going to jump on is, you know, and this is the first and the last time I'm going to mention the former president, is that this is the first time that the predecessor wasn't at the inauguration. And well, I thought that that was kind of a telling circumstance. And it was representative of the kind of disruption and turmoil that we had over the last several years.
I think it was, I don't know if it was the very first one. I thought there were some, like, you know, ancient ones that, yeah, John Quincy Adams, I think, was unwilling to be at the inauguration for Andrew Jackson. I don't think he was there for Thomas Jefferson's swearing in. Interestingly, just a little bit of trivia for you. I read about the remodel that President Biden has done in the Oval Office, and he's put a picture of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson next to each other. They were famous rivals, and he put them next to each other to remind himself that the point and purpose is to bring people together and to make compromises and to get some stuff done. So I actually wasn't bothered that Donald Trump didn't attend the inauguration because he has never conceded formally and, you know, congratulated President Biden on winning. He's perpetuated lies about the election's results, and he's endangered the lives of, you know, election workers in a couple of different states, and some elected officials. And so I actually felt like it made it easier and put everyone at ease. It's kind of like having someone come to your party because it's the right thing to do, but not because it's the comfortable thing to do. And after watching people storm the Capitol last week, I'm fine with a little bit of comfort and peace, and not and let's just throw tradition aside for right now.
You know, it's interesting that if I'm not mistaken, that was almost 2 weeks to the day. It was, I think, the storming happened on a Wednesday, I believe. Mm-hmm. But you know, that kind of thing happened, and then we find ourselves a new president. So I want to get your opinion. What did you think of the inauguration? For me, the thing I thought was great was there was this obvious display of diversity when we haven't seen that as much over the last couple of years. And I the one thing is having the youngest poet laureate or poet speak at the inauguration was, you know, yeah. Again, now it was, it, to me, it represented some hopefulness, some progress, and just more inclusiveness.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that was striking. Not having a crowd was striking. I thought
about that? Just, you know, it did give it was a weird kind of circumstance. You feel like you're just expecting to see, you know, throngs of people from the last inauguration to the one before that. And then All of a sudden, because of fears and you know, kind of trepidation about what could happen.
And the pandemic,
certainly.
Yeah,
there was no one. At least they could even social distance.
Well, and they had them kind of separated out. Even the people that were there, the elected officials who attended, were separated, you know, and they sat in group together with people they brought or from their homes. But I think actually it was, for me, I almost got a little choked up about that because I thought, he's acknowledging that we're dealing with a pandemic. I feel like our lives, normal people's lives, are so upended by this pandemic. And our former president has just carried on having rallies and, you know, doing whatever he wants, things in the Rose Garden, and nobody needs to wear a mask and nobody needs a social distance, and sort of been at war with the idea that we're even in a pandemic, and keeps telling us, oh, things are better and it's going to go away next week or whatever. I felt like it was a sobering acknowledgement that we are in the midst of a once-in-a-century pandemic. And, you know, the fact that 400,000 Americans have died, I just felt like the entire week was like, let's come back to reality. And I was emotional off and on. I mean, I cried when Kamala Harris was sworn in by Justice Sonia Sotomayor. I thought his inauguration speech was it was wonderful. It was soothing, and it didn't get political or make big promises or whatever. But it was like when you go to someone you trust and love, and they tell you it's going to be all right. Right. We're really capable. We're good. I mean, I don't know. I just found it to be very like chicken soup and warm homemade bread, and it was just. And then to end with The Hill We Climb from Amanda Gorman, who is unbelievable, remarkable. I look at myself at 22, 23 years old. I was just
What did we accomplish by then?
I was so proud to have a job.
Let alone it. And I don't know that I could have stood in front of a non-crowd or any crowd on national television.
The world.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was so perfect. You know, it was just the perfect end to what I thought was a really fitting inauguration for the time we're in and the place we need to be and the place we need to go. And I did have some interesting conversations after with my friends and family of various political affiliations. And, you know, they're sad, they're scared. Yep. And I will remind people that that's how I felt, how we felt when Trump took office. And somebody said that to me when Trump won. They said, well, we felt this way when Obama was elected. And I do wonder, Jason, if we're ever going to get to a place where a third of us are not terrified of our leadership.
I'm with you 100%. I got to be honest with you. I hate that so many people are, as hopeful as we are, they're just as disillusioned and afraid that, you know, something terrible is going to happen. I've had a couple of interactions, one more friendly than the other one, with people who are, you know, they're Second Amendment people, right? Mm-hmm. And they are worried that, you know, the new administration is going to come get their guns. I'm like, first of all, I'm a gun owner. They're not taking my gun from me. Charlton Heston from my cold dead hand, right? So I don't fear that, because I just know that that's not going to happen. It's baked into the Constitution. It's part of our country. It's part of the founding of our country. It's the reason we have the country in the first place. Being all of us in totality, despite the fact that, you know, myself and the people of Native American heritage were not quite included in that. But I would suggest to you that hopelessness, I believe, is misplaced. But I understand why they feel that way, and I don't dismiss it. I just wish there was some way I could give them comfort in knowing, just like when I remember talking to one of my conservative friends at the gym right after the election. I said, you know what, as much as I think this is crazy, the Republic will survive.
Yeah.
And there is the Republic is too great to just be destroyed by any person in the White House. It just is.
Yeah. And I hope people take comfort in knowing that that's how afraid we were. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I do also think we need to talk as people about how we can get to a better place of governing, because I think this really divisive, the pendulum swinging back, you know, really far one way and then really far the other way. And this is, I won, so I can do whatever I want to you. I really hope we could get rid of that. I think Joe Biden does bring a different tone, and he has a history of sort of working across party lines. And so maybe he can be the one to deliver that kind of leadership. I don't know.
I'm hoping that you're exactly right. But when we come back, I want to talk about Joe Biden, because he's the new president. And he got his pen, it was smoking on day one of his presidency with all the executive actions he could squeeze into 24 hours. That's going to be our next topic when we continue. You're listening to Voices of Reason. I'm Jason Lee. She's Amy Donaldson. We'll be right back.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. they pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
We are back with the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason, Amy Donaldson and Jason Lee. And we're going to talk now about Joe Biden's first day in office, which has to be one of the more active days in office in recent memory. The president got his pen out, and it was smoking by the time it was over. Mm-hmm. 17 executive orders, beginning with reengaging with the World Health Organization, creating a position of COVID response coordinator, rejoining the Paris Climate Accord. I remember that was a big deal. Revoking the Keystone Pipeline to pause energy leasing there in Anwar, the wildlife reserve in Alaska, and asking agencies to kind of extend the moratoriums on evictions and foreclosures, which has become a really big issue, particularly at the beginning of this year. Extending student loan pauses, launching an initiative to advance racial equity, and in the 1776 Commission, I wasn't quite aware of that. Revoke orders to exclude undocumented immigrants from the census. How about that? Preserve and fortify DACA, which helps Dreamers. That was probably the thing to me that meant the most, because it just helps these young people not have to worry about something that was never their fault to begin with. And they have to figure out a way to make a path for them to become citizens. I feel like that's Congress needs to really work on that order. Reverse the travel ban to primarily Muslim countries. I'd almost forgotten about that, that they were still doing that. Stop construction of the border wall, thank goodness. And combat.
And actually as part of that executive order, they're going to do a review of this emergency declaration that allowed President Trump to divert money
that's
from
right.
other, from like cybersecurity in Homeland Security, and use that for the border wall. So they're actually going to look at whether or not that was even legal.
Because that's how they were able to actually
keep
it going.
That's how they funded it.
That's right.
I think the first $5 billion was legitimately funded, but they've spent $15 billion that I know, that last I read.
And Mexico hasn't reimbursed us at all.
Jason, they did pay for it. Come on.
They're going to eventually.
Remember, though, you want to keep going with your rundown, because you haven't hit the mask wearing on federal property during interstate travel.
So they got discrimination to combat sexual orientation and gender ID, require ethics pledge for executive branch personnel, modernize and improve regulatory review, end harsh and extreme immigration enforcement, extend protection from deportation for Liberians in the USA. How about specifically the Liberian?
Yeah.
Revoke certain executive orders concerning federal regulation, freeze any new pending regulations, fill in supply shortfalls in fight versus COVID-19, and also increase FEMA reimbursement for National Guard for their PPE. Establish a pandemic testing board and expand testing. More clinical treatments for COVID-19 and improve analysis of related data. Mount vaccine campaign, such as 100 million shots in 100 days. I'll be interested to see if that even goes anywhere. Let's see what you mentioned. Require masks, face masks at airports and other modes of transportation. I love
buses.
That.
Love
that. Restore bargaining power for federal workers. Establish agencies to boost food aid and improve delivery of stimulus checks. And I also think to myself, one of the things that was important to me, at least, I don't remember getting a $600 check this last time, but so I don't know if it ever came to me. But I wonder that he talked about working on a plan to extend federal stimulus, giving more money to Americans. And, kind of keeping this thing going while we're still in this pandemic. And I wonder if that is something that'll be fiscally possible. And if that's going to be something that Congress will take up and move along, or if it'll get stalled.
Well, I think you're going to see the tax cuts rolled back. There's no way to fund some of this stuff. And remember, the Trump tax cuts were back end loaded. So we were going to have a little bit of benefit if you're in the middle of the range, or if you're at the bottom. I didn't see any, I don't know about you, but I didn't see any benefit. But
neither did I.
Yeah. And then there were people above us who got a pretty significant cut, and businesses got some good cuts, but they were always gonna start the bill was gonna come due for that, I believe 2022. I think we'll maybe see us start that bill will start coming due a little bit earlier. They were never paid for. It was basically a charge on the credit card that we were just gonna ask somebody to pay for down the road. They didn't stimulate the economy enough to pay for themselves. They didn't even come close. It significantly increased the deficit. And the thing you're going to hear right now is, but the deficit. And I am 100% on board with looking at spending, but I think it's just, it's really an indictment of who we are, that we don't bat an eyelash to give tax cuts to wealthy and corporations, but we will, complain all the way to the bank when we're talking about safety net programs and social programs that help the poorest and sickest among us.
There's part of me that believes, and I know this is over a bit of hyperbole, right? Mm-hmm. That we show so little compassion for those who are less fortunate than us in terms of resources and financially. And, you know, I have never felt like giving poor people food or shelter is going to somehow diminish my ability to do what it is and live the way I live, you know. I don't get that, particularly from people who are particularly wealthy. And they say to themselves, their lives don't change at all. But what you do by giving these people who have so little a bit is it changes their lives. It changes their mm-hmm. outlook. It gives yeah. them hope. It gives mm-hmm. them a reason to try to, climb so that they can help themselves and then be able to help other people who might have been in the same position as them. I've never understand that kind of harshness.
I 100% agree. And I think we ought to ask ourselves that. If you were on the side of tax cuts that we couldn't pay for, then I don't really want to hear from you when we talk about social programs for the poorest and for children, you know, pre-K for kids, universal pre-K. The public education system, as much maligned as it is and as much help as it needs right now and as hard as it's been during this pandemic year, is one of the shining jewels of this country. It is one of the reasons we are the power that we are, is that every kid is entitled to an education. And you can have a lot of issues with the way we've delivered it, but the fact that that's a cornerstone of this, of our society, that's a huge, huge, commitment. And I love that our state government, our new governor here, has made such a significant investment in education. I think it's going to be a profoundly impactful decision if the legislature follows through.
I remember when Olene Walker, who was the first female governor of Utah and one of the truly underrated mm-hmm. politicians in the history of the state of Utah. I mean, she yeah. was a brilliant woman, and she should have gotten way more credit than she got. And she was also, she'd been an educator, so she recognized the importance of improving education and giving people a chance to have a leg up. And especially when we, as a state, have technology as one of our largest growth industries, we needed to have more emphasis on that. And I'm hoping that the new governor, Spencer J. Cox, who is a friend of this program, will be able to, you know, make some more inroads in helping to improve our educational system. When we come back, I want to continue on the discussion about what to hopefully look forward to in this new administration and some of the things that we'd like to see tackled as we move forward. She's Amy. I'm Jason. This is Voices of Reason. Back with the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason, Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. And as it turns out, we bring you breaking news on occasion when it happens. And the last segment, we talked about the variety of executive orders
yes.
That Joe Biden has actually signed already. And again, as we record this on Friday, the 22nd of January, the executive order continues.
Yes, the flurry, he's still got the pen out. And right. and there's two things I wanted to say. I wanted to tell you there are two new executive orders today, Friday. And one of those is focused on expanding food assistance and delivering stimulus checks to very low-income Americans. And the other one is raising the minimum wage for federal workforce to $15 an hour. So I think those are both good things. Here's my issue. Do we really want the executive branch to have as much power as it has, right? It has, the last four presidents have relied on executive power to get really critical things done. Outside of the Affordable Care Act, Obama had to, he created DACA through an executive order, which I was in favor of DACA. I was not in favor of it being an executive order. I thought that should have been a congressional act. And guess what happened? The next president tried to roll it back and caused all kinds of havoc on the program. And then now Joe Biden's going to reinstate it. Do you really want these laws to change every 4 years? Because Trump undid a bunch of what Obama did. And now you have Biden undoing what Trump did. And I think it's a really ineffective way to govern. But, you know.
The alternative is doing nothing. See, and that's a problem. You and I have discussed this for a long time. Mm-hmm. Congress there's been so much gridlock that there mm-hmm. hasn't been the bipartisanship to pass effective legislation, especially regarding immigration and education. And just the ability and the minimum wage. We've had the fact that we can't get to these issues and make some substantive change has always been disconcerting to me. And somehow we don't get as far as we'd like. I mean, Rob Bishop told us that there are still things going on that we don't necessarily recognize. But on the whole, the larger issues, they don't seem to be addressed, certainly not expediently, if ever at all.
Yeah, I mean, so I mean, philosophically, you know, I align more with President Biden. And so I'm in favor of rolling back some of those changes that Trump made. But I was never in favor of them being executive orders in the first place. And I really think we should all ask ourselves, how do we get Congress to do what it's supposed to do? You know, I mean, it's going to be interesting right now. There's this big debate over the filibuster. You know, there's a 50-50 split in Congress between the two parties. You know, Kamala Harris has a tie-break vote.
In the Senate, that's right.
Yeah, so that helps the Democrats. But, you know, what? Everyone's like, well, we have a majority. We can do whatever we want. You know, Mitch McConnell in 2017 was like, elections have consequences, and this is the consequence.
This
the winners
exactly
get to.
What happened.
They get to, yeah. And so.
To the winners go the spoils.
The spoils. And do we really want, should government be like war or sport? Where the winner takes all and the losers resign to an asterisk, right? I think not. I think governing has to be different. And I really don't know how we get there, especially when a third of the country still believes, you know, absolute fiction about the election.
That the prior president is still the president, or at least it was stolen. You know, and the funny thing is, you know, look, I can't believe I'm about to say this, that I'm looking back fondly of the days of Ronald Reagan, for instance, when he and Tip O'Neill, who then was the Speaker of the House, a Democrat and a Republican, the president, would have lunch or dinner together, and they would discuss what measures they could work on so that they could pass these laws. Mm-hmm. And today, Trump rarely ever talked to Nancy Pelosi. In fact, he would ridicule her, and she wasn't much better, by the way. I'm not taking sides.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, Trump presented some unique difficulties. He had a really estranged relationship with the truth. And you can say whatever you want about him philosophically. You can agree with him, be aligned with his policies or not. But he cannot tell the truth about a lot of things. And so when you're dealing with somebody who doesn't tell the truth or who makes things up, it's very difficult to have a grown-up conversation. Or, I mean, he would do things even with his supporters, you know, in Congress, where he would say, we're going to do this by Friday. And then somebody in Congress would tell him, like, that's not possible. This is what we have to do. And he would say, well, I want to sign an executive order. I mean, like, he didn't understand governing. And so, and also he was, you know, fundamentally dishonest person. And I think that created a difficulty for Nancy Pelosi because should you negotiate? And I've had this difficulty. You and I have even had this conversation. I like to talk to people who disagree with me philosophically or politically or in any way, but I have trouble bringing people on who are going to tell untruths. I don't want to spread misinformation. I don't want to be a source of untruths or conspiracies.
Well, I think that, you know, again, you have to be able to have a discussion. And it's very difficult to have discussions with people who, like you say, don't necessarily tell the truth. But more importantly, they don't want to hear what you have to say. And even, like, I remember when Obama was president, he and John Boehner famously would golf together.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah.
Boehner would be terrible to him on national television. But apparently they had a relationship, and it was relatively cordial. So if that's the case, if I can watch somebody, you know, kind of excoriate them, their rival, even if he was the president, on television, but then behind the scenes, when, you know, things need to get done, they actually have meetings, they have discussions, they try to work through things in a way that's constructive for the better for the good of the country. That's, I can live with that, because those are people who are trying at least to find common ground, trying to find a way to, you win a little, I win a little, the country wins in general. That's the kind of leadership that this country needs right now, because we can't, this divisiveness, you know, it's, people are, you know, not wanting to have family members over for, you know, when we could, for holiday dinners and stuff like that.
I mean, yeah, we can't right now.
When did
COVID may have saved a few family
right,
relationships.
Right, exactly, at least for a time. I have plenty of conservative friends who I find are smart, respectful, and I appreciate their opinion despite the fact that I may disagree with them. Mm-hmm. Spencer Cox is a great example of that. I love that guy. But I would know that as he and I, politically, we disagree on a whole bunch. But as human beings, we can have conversations where we can discuss those kinds of things.
And for me, I feel like I was a moderate conservative. I was maybe a left-leaning conservative before Donald Trump. And I feel like Donald Trump turned me into a flaming liberal. You know, I don't
flaming
know.
Flaming liberal has changed. What used to be moderate is now flaming.
Exactly. But I also think
that
I
just a hippie.
I feel like I've just gone super extreme, and I'm trying very desperately to moderate myself, to figure out, you know, to follow the example of some of the people we've talked about today, you know, especially this young woman, Amanda Gorman. Like, if you can't find what you're looking for, maybe you should be what you're looking for. And I think I just have to figure out how to do that again. I feel like I've lost my way in my own, like, distress and I'll be frank, hatred of somebody that I thought was trying to dismantle our country and all of its institutions. So I just feel like it's an extreme situation, and so I don't know that I'm gonna fault people too much for not working with Donald Trump, because I think he was an aberration. I hope he's an aberration.
But, you know, I've had conversations with people who I disagree with, and they've offered, they may have a different principle than me, and they may say that my principle is the reason I feel this way is because this is how I feel, not necessarily because it's logical. That I can appreciate, because at least they understand where they're coming from, and so do I now. I may disagree with it. However, at least we have come to an understanding. We have to have more of those kinds of conversations where it's not necessarily adversarial, but at least exchanging ideas, explaining why this person is here and why I might be there. And even if we don't come together, we at least see where the other one is. And if you can see eye to eye, just knowing what we're talking about, that's a start. When we come back, we want to talk about what we'd like to see and what's in our bag of hope for the country in the coming years. I'm Jason. She's Amy. This is Voices of Reason. We are back with the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason, Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. And I wanted to use this last few minutes we have talking about what we hope to see tackled, politically speaking, in Washington with the new administration. And I would start off with saying, like I said, immigration was always a huge thing for me, because knowing now that there are so many people who had their lives upended by not having a safety net and not having hope for an option to potentially stay in a place where they probably only ever known, or they've been here for so long, they realize that this is the place they want to be and they want to contribute to. And I think rather than wanting to send them all back, because that's kind of the separatist idea that I'm not on board with, I'd like to see a situation where we could find where somebody, you give them maybe 5 years to work. You have to pay some certain amount. You have to learn, you know, pass some citizenship requirements so that at that point they can apply and, you know, have a reasonable road to becoming a naturalized citizen. And then that's, to me, that's one of the more important things we have to really address, because there are too many people out there whose lives are in limbo, and that's just nowhere to live.
Well, and I think aside from the humanitarian side of the immigration issues, which in DACA, most people support some kind of DACA program for kids who come here as you know, their parents bring them. They didn't choose this. This is the only country they know. Most people can be on board with providing DACA kids some citizenship protections and maybe even a path to citizenship. Where it gets murky is their parents or other people who came to this country illegally or who are undocumented for other reasons. They overstayed a visa or whatever. And I would say this, solving the immigration problem isn't just a humanitarian issue. And it certainly is, in my opinion, a huge and critical humanitarian issue. But it's also a huge and critical economic issue. Because as long as we have people who live here undocumented, they are able to be victimized by unscrupulous companies and business owners. And they drive wages down. And when you want to feel bad about something or get mad at somebody, get mad at the people who take advantage of undocumented people, but who will not fight for their right to be here legitimately. And because they're paying taxes. They're not entitled to benefits. This stuff that you, these memes you see on Facebook, they're not true. They can't get benefits. They can't take advantage of public programs that citizens have access to, or legal residents, or people who are here with documentation. So they live such a shadowed life, shadow of a life here. And in some cases, it's still better than the situation they were fleeing. But it's a huge economic issue, and I would love to see us start looking at immigration as everybody's problem, not just the problem of people who happen to have been born somewhere else or be in a situation that we find, you know, untenable. This is an American problem. This country was founded on people who came here for some kind of religious freedom or political freedom or to flee persecution. That's a cornerstone of who we are. That's not changing. Own it and make it part of our systems going forward.
And I you know, so that's the one thing I'm still kind of worried about. I don't know that I worry about anything more than that, other than just equity and equality, whether it be race, gender, sexual orientation, because, again, what is supposed to be a cornerstone, though it was not when the country was first founded. Let's make that perfectly clear. This was about white slave owners.
Well, but they felt persecuted.
That's right.
But
when they founded the country, they made it so that their lives would be great, and everybody else was kind of here, but they were to be the working class.
Yeah, but what they unwittingly did, or maybe wittingly, I don't know. They baked into this situation, like you say, that they were making for their own advantage, mm-hmm. that they felt gave them an advantage. They also baked into it these ideas that give us all hope, right? That made America something different. And so, yeah, we're scrambling and trying to figure out who we are and how to live up to those ideals. But they baked in some pretty lofty, you know, aspirations. And I want us to take those things into heart and say, we need to, a rising tide lifts all boats. If America's better for everybody, it's better for you. Let me say, I heard this thing in my meditation, and I think it was from Pope John Paul, but he talked about how the river doesn't drink its own water, and the sun doesn't shine on itself. In nature, one thing feeds another, right? And that's when you live for other people. It's great to be happy, but it's better that other people are happy because of you. And I think that's where we have to get back to.
You think that that's a place where people are willing to go?
Yes, I think we have gotten caught up, and the pandemic has made this worse, in this idea of if other people have something, I have less. And what we mm-hmm. need to the mindset we need to shift to is, if other people have something, they will create more for me and mine. We will all lift each other, help each other. Nobody gets left behind, because that's who we have to become. That country where nobody falls through the cracks. There's a safety net for everybody, and everybody doing better means we are all doing better.
We do actually have a fair amount of abundance here. I always say there's no way that people should starve, because we throw away more food than any place, I would imagine, because it's just crazy.
Absolutely. And I was just going to point out that their top three, like, first 100-day type priorities are the COVID issue, which I think if you don't get control of a pandemic, and that includes economic relief and the distribution of the vaccine and testing, you know, you have to have a comprehensive COVID, you know, plan and be able to execute it. That nothing matter. Nothing else will matter. So get the pandemic under control is critical. But then they said infrastructure and climate change and immigration. And immigration is in my top three, but also in my top three is healthcare. Because if COVID has taught me anything, it is that we cannot keep delivering healthcare the way we are through private insurance companies, almost exclusively tied to your job. When people lost their jobs, they lost their healthcare. We can't be that country anymore. That has proven to be an absolute failure of a system. So I hope that gets addressed as well.
Well, you know what? I'm going to say amen to that, because it is possibly, other than maybe that immigration thing we just talked about, it may be the most important thing we have going right now, because it is such a prevalent issue during this pandemic. We have to be able to at least address the health issues of all Americans. Mm-hmm. And all people in America, not just Americans necessarily. And we need to figure out a way to make that happen sooner, way rather than later. Listen, join us for the next episode of the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. If you have any comments about our show, please contact us via email at vormed@gmail.com or at vorjasonl@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter at adonsports and at jasonlee1. Our show's Twitter handle is @VORpodcast. Check out our Facebook page, and you can also find and subscribe to free episodes of our podcast and all the places where you find interesting content. Be sure to review our show as well. We love to get your feedback, and it helps us grow our audience. Until next time, I'm Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. When you engage in passionate debate, do your best to keep your dialogue civil. Try to be the voice of reason.
Voices of Reason is a production of the Loudmouth Project.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com, follow us on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.